know that you are as passionate as we are about how we improve services, and clearly there are lots of people in the country, particularly in perhaps rural parts of the country, where it's not easy for them to access a specialist service. So how do we help to take the learning from what we've learned from you and your learning from yourself out into the next iteration of the inspection programme? And I'd just like to spend a little bit of time perhaps with you to have some conversations in little groups between yourselves and then bringing that back into some feedback. Okay, so can I just ask, how many of you have been subject or subjected to a CQC inspection already, depending on
how
you're due on next Friday? Marvellous. So some of you, for some of you, this will be quite familiar, but just I think worth saying. As you know, our job is to make sure that people receive safe, effective, compassionate and high quality health and social care services. And there's this endless debate, and those of you that might do things like read the Roy Lilly blog will know there's this endless conversation about what role regulators play in improvement. Our view is that clearly we're not an improvement vehicle. It's a bit hard to be both the assessor and the person that group that comes alongside you to say, how can we help you get better? But we absolutely are clear that our job is to signpost people to best practice, help to share best practice, share those characteristics so that other services can be encouraged to improve. And we do know, as long as I've been in the health and social care system, that we have to reinvent every wheel locally, and we're not very good at disseminating what works has been a long-standing plea within our services. In order to do that, we register, monitor, inspect and regulate services against these things called the fundamental standards. And we do want to be a strong, independent and expert voice, but particularly, and no need to say that in this room, primarily on the side of people who use services. And again, you can appreciate that sometimes one of the areas that can get a bit tense around, you know, organisations that are in difficulty, staff situations that are in difficulty, about what it is that we feel that we need to say on behalf of people who use services. I won't spend a lot of time on this, except for to say, in the green box, we've got something called independent voice. And that's where we try to pull together our findings of thematic reports, the statutory report we produce once a year called State of Care. I don't know whether you've seen our State of Care report, which is our summation of the key issues and themes that we found. And we are about to start a thematic piece of work with one of our clinical fellows on services for what we found around homelessness services and services for people whose other circumstances make them vulnerable. And we're going to try and employ that learning. Because some of you will be in hospital trusts providing these services, some of you will be in community services, some of you will be in general practice. So the purpose of that will be to pull that together. And if any of you, as well as what we found from our reports, but if those of you who haven't got round to having an inspection yet want to share things with us, that would be fantastic. So as you know, we ask, at the moment, we ask five questions. Are services safe? Are they effective? Are they caring? Are they responsive? And are they well led? And I won't go through the detail of that, but that's the basis for the way in which we approach our roles. And then for each of those questions, there are a number of what we call lines of inquiry. So for example, in the safe domain, there are lots of questions about how do you identify patients on your list or on your caseload, however it is you talk about it, who, for example, are at risk of abuse? How do you do that? How do you document that? How do you make sure that your staff are trained? And for each of the queries, we describe at the moment what good looks like. And what we haven't done so much of yet is, what does outstanding look like? So at the moment, we're finding outstanding is different from good. but I think there's a great hunger out there, because I'm sure you all aspire, and if you are delivering outstanding services, but aspire to know, are we? How do we benchmark ourselves? How do we know that we are outstanding? And they're about consistency. Clearly, one of the challenges of being a regulator, you know, my team by the end of this year is going to have inspected 8,400 general practices in London. And as a nurse practitioner who works in general practice, that's a really interesting dilemma, as it is for hospital services and trusts. How do we, they'd be 8,400 really different organisations, really different culturally, really different in terms of size, really different in terms of the populations that they serve. And one of the fantastic things about general practice is its uniqueness and its diversity. And how do we as a regulator not squash out and say, no, you all have to be the same, you all have to be very standard, you all have to do the same things, you all have to smile for exactly 3 seconds every time a new patient comes through the door. And some of the things that people think we want. So how do we do that in a way that doesn't squash the diversity, doesn't recognise the value that particularly patients feel about that diversity, about their practice and what attracts them to a practice and to staying in the practice. But we do need to have enough structure in what we're doing that it feels fair and that we can make comparisons, and that when you get your report and you look against the practice up the road that perhaps got different ratings, you can look at that and see what was the basis of that assessment and how is that standardised. And one of the things you may wish to give me feedback on later, because normally it's one of the things that comes up, is this issue about standardisation. We've also tried, because as many of you will know, Steve has a long time had a leadership role in the whole health inequalities, equality and diversity world, to say, well, clearly those questions are 5 questions that cut across all patients or clients receiving services. But in the general practice primary care world, we also work with trying to tease out particular issues for these client groups. Older people, people with long-term conditions, families, children and young people, working age people, and people living in vulnerable circumstances and people experience poor mental health. I think that most of our homeless population could fit in quite a lot of those groups, and that there are aspects of the care that they need that is everywhere. But at the moment, we focus the specifics, most of the specific questions about homelessness in the people living in vulnerable circumstances. But the other questions would apply. So if many of them have long-term conditions, we talked about many of them have poor mental health issues and substance issues, we would look at those right across the client groups. But at the moment, we pick it out in people living in vulnerable circumstances. So again, is that the right place to give it that sort of profile? Well, saying we're not only concerned about their homelessness status, we're concerned about all the other factors that have got them there and all the other elements of care that they need. So at the moment, as of the 31st of January, the exhausted team across the country has done just over 2,800 inspections. And those are what the ratings look like. I'm hoping the next one is a graph that makes it a little bit easier. So this is what I think many of you know already, is that the vast majority of general practice, certainly, and those other services that are rating, is currently being rated as good. I think what I would say to you is that the area under the curve of good is quite wide. And the gap between just good and nearly outstanding is really wide at the moment. And I know that you, as well as we, would be interested in what needs to happen to narrow that area under the curve. Because for patients, that's the bit about the lottery. And Steve would say to you that when he gets what was going to happen, despite some of the controversy he gets in the press, was that kind of curve. So I think he thought we'll get about 4% outstanding, we'll get about 4% inadequate,
quite where we've based it between good and requires improvement has been a little bit more open for discussion.
But there's quite a lot of national variation.
Oh, sorry. And these are the ratings by domain. And you can see the one that for anybody that knows me, I pop up and down quite a lot about, for example, is caring. So I sit in our National Quality Assurance Panel, where we quality assure particularly inadequate and outstanding reports. And it will be, a practice will come forward and it will be inadequate in well-led, it will be inadequate in responsive, it will probably be requires improvement in effective, and it will be inadequate in safe. And it will be good in caring. And it will be good in caring, because at the moment caring, the only real data we've got in caring is the patient survey. And the patient survey data is usually really small in terms of number of patients that respond. We know that the relationships that patients have with their general practice and their general practitioners can be really complicated, particularly if you're vulnerable in terms of how you rate that. Your knowledge or expectations of what to expect can be very low. So I once, when I was commissioning services, came across a practice where we discovered, after a really long time, that the GP who was providing perinatal care and was licensed, registered to provide perinatal care, never, ever, 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 ever examined a woman between the nipple and the knee. So he did all the pre and postnatal care, he never did an examination. I didn't have a single solitary complaint about that. You know why? Because he was serving a population of women who would not have wanted a male GP to conduct an intimate examination. So the fact he didn't offer was not a problem. And that's what sometimes gets wrapped up in caring, and I find it really hard to have a practice that has no lithium screening in place, no proper identification of patients in terms of their medicines management around long-term conditions, isn't able to offer people appointments, and for whom both the environment of care is unsafe and they're very shady about how it is that they register vulnerable people, particularly some of the homelessness conversations that went on with our panel, and I still have to rate them as good for care. So I think there's a really interesting discussion about how we get underneath this caring discussion. It absolutely has to be something that's from the perspective of patients and service users, but I find it really hard to say it's caring to be giving such poor care. So I'd be really interested in your views about that. And it breaks down very differently geographically. So those of you from the north, going to get your trains later. So you are currently 85%. Good. 8% requires improvement, and the classic 4% at either end. London. This won't be a surprise to any of us who've spent our lives in London. We are currently at 77.5% and growing in terms of inadequates, and 19% in terms of requires improvement, and only 2.5% in terms of outstanding. And I think several of the outstandings will be represented in this room in terms of the nine, because quite a lot of them are linked with specialist services, particularly homeless services. Fairly similar in the south. But then we've got devastating pockets. So if you're in Thurrock, in Essex, everybody in Essex, devastating pocket. We've inspected seven, four, five are inadequate to our requires improvement. The poor person that went there was a new inspector. She hasn't inspected a good practice yet. I have to keep reminding her that they do exist, because it is quite depressing when it is. So we've got quite a lot of country variation. We know, I'm say this, I know a couple of people in the room, but we think that when we get into some of the Lancashire mill towns, we're going to find some challenges. There are some real challenges in places like inner city Birmingham. We find quite, and the other thing is, it's got nothing to do with the size of, it's got little to do with the size of the practice. So the other thing is that people think that we're out to get single handed practices. We're not, and I'll explain that in a little while. So, anybody here from the Stratford?
So we have started, and Salford was the first outstanding practice that we rated. And again, inner city, lots of specialist services, including really good care for their homes and vulnerable people. So what made these practices outstanding? We think that first and foremost, what this question is good leadership with a really strong learning culture, really strong values, and staff who responded and were passionate about improvement. And we are working with Professor Michael West to actually develop a leadership questionnaire, which we hope to be part of the methodology. And we think getting underneath this leadership, if my colleague, my superior, Professor Mike Richards, were here, who's the chief inspector of hospitals, he says the two most important bits of data he has for hospital inspection are the patient survey and the staff survey. So what the staff say about what it's like to work there. The second thing I think is multi-professional and multidisciplinary working, particularly within the practice. So really strong teams, really getting the best out of all of those skills. And I am a nurse, I would say that, but often in terms of how the practice nursing staff and the practice medical staff work together. When I show you the inadequate practice, you'll see a kind of mirror image. So in the inadequate practice, nurses say we never get a chance to have a clinical conversation with our GPs. In outstanding practices, there's a really strong team, and then there's a really strong team that is stepping out into the local, and they've got services, they're really well connected with the local community and hospital services. Sometimes that's a bit difficult, because sometimes that might be also an assessment in a sense of a really good CCG or commissioning arrangement that's racked some really good mental health and other specialist services around their practices, and other places that can't demonstrate that, it's not entirely their fault, there's nothing to outreach to talk to that's been commissioned in a way that makes it practice centric. We try to, in the visits, we try to understand that. And the practice reaches out into the local community. And again, that's a bit of a no-brainer for homelessness services, really, isn't it? That's what you're really good at, that bit of that outreach, that bit of that understanding communities. I talked about the learning bit. and access is really, really important. And that's quite difficult because, you know, part of the sense of where the pressure is on general practice at the moment is the conversations about the expectations put by politicians that you can ring up at any time of the night or day with anything and get a response. But in terms of managing vulnerable populations and demonstrating outcomes for vulnerable populations, how that is organised and managed, how the appointment system is managed, how people do triage. So it's not about everybody being able to, for whatever reason, but it's about how is the practice, how they flagged on their system the people that if they ring for an appointment, they're going to get one and they're going to get one fast. And how do they manage that demand? And then the final thing that they do is that they have really, really, really strong patient and public involvement. There are some great models of virtual practice participation groups. You know, we've had several practice participation groups on a virtual basis who have engagement from more than 30% of the patient list in the course of 1 year. And it's more than the usual six really keen people who meet together in the waiting room with the practice manager once a week. Common examples in the domains: strong safety culture across the whole team, strong significant event analysis, but also sharing that, so these practices are always engaged. I mean, even where they're single-handed practices, there's two practices on Dartmoor, individual single-handed practices, really passionate about being single-handed, but actually really well connected and supporting each other, and really well connected services. So it's about professional and practice isolation, it's not about whether you're single-handed. So some of our very small practices are doing this fantastic practice up in Coniston that's serving that farming population really well. Effective has a lot to do with how they think about training up their staff to support the needs of their patients. They provide a range of compassionate additional services, where particularly things like caring and inclusion healthcare. So again, we've got an example here, you're already doing it too, where the practice paid for a dying homeless man who'd never been to the sea to go to the sea. There are other practices who bring patients in early to give them breakfast and making themselves clothes. There's a whole range of amazing stuff going on. How do we make that possible, those sorts of aspirations for people who aren't in those specialist practices? To say, what's that little bit extra that you might need about doing to really help this population? We've talked about proactive reaching out, we've talked about and strong personal and professional development opportunities for staff. So we're trying to work to disseminate that good practice, but we also recognise that even practices that we find as good and requires improvement, we need to acknowledge that even within requires improvement, there will be some brilliant things that they're doing. And often what happens is you've got some really great care going on, perhaps around specific interests within the patient. So there's somebody who's really passionate about diabetes or COPD, and there's great care going on in that area. It's just not happening across the board. A number of practices in reality, I go into a few more of them in London, but I do go into practices where there are 367 unmatched pathology results. There are 72 referral letters sitting in a pile that aren't going anywhere, that can't be identified to individual patients, to even know who to send them off to, and at least 20 of them should have been going in on the cancer 2-week pathway, and we have no idea how long they've been sitting there. I've never actually seen 3 layers of dust, 3 inches of dust in a fridge before, and I know people think we're obsessed with fridges, but when everything in the fridge is out of date, and you're giving NMR injections that are like that. So we do occasionally come across things that are gobsmackingly awful, but that's unusual. Most of the time we come across people who are really trying to do their best in often quite challenging circumstances, and who the opportunity for help is really important, and I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. So in general, outstanding practices are doing innovative solutions to help tackle inequalities, problems and unmet needs. They show tangible improvements for patients, and that's the difference with all of you, is that most of you have some academic links or something that enables you to do some good evaluation data on improved life expectancy, reduced use of emergency care services. The question for us is, how do we make that scalable, and how do we communicate with other bits of the system, and that they involve the whole practice, and again, they often really often engage in CCG work and stuff, trying to disseminate that stuff locally. How do we help that get disseminated for them? So all the specialist services at the moment, so 4 out of 6 are outstanding, 2 are good, and for the 2 that were good, they were just little things, important things, but things that will take 5 minutes to fix, and we'll go in and inspect them quickly so that it's a fair rate. Highly motivated teams, really strong values, highly accessible, all that stuff that academic needs, and based on strong local needs assessment, but often something that you sometimes struggle with to connect that. I heard people today talking about, how do we connect that to the joint strategic needs assessment? How do we get that data into the wider system so that we're able to make a bit of a difference? And I hope that we can have some of these conversations through this vulnerable person thematic review that we're going to do. I think we can help to capture and really highlight a whole range of good practice, but also issues that we can then help the system to identify. So this is what inadequate looks like. So not undertaking any significant events, not storing medicine properly, not having staff that are screened properly, not even having staff who are sometimes registered, never mind have a DBS checks. So there was a practice in the southwest where the GP had, where the GP had been suspended by the GMC, and he had employed an osteopath to impersonate the GP in the practice, and that's who was there. So, gobsmackingly things when we have those, when we get together and have conversations about, what have you found this week. So, there can be some really serious things that we
little concerned about privacy and dignity, not really doing anything around end-of-life care. And these are the practices where that conversation about, so how do you enable homeless or vulnerable people without fixed abodes to register with you? Oh, there aren't any of those patients here. There are no patients in this community. Have interesting conversations. I'm not surprised I have interesting conversations in Godalming on this subject or bits of Richmond, but all the practices say, oh yes, and they've got the guidance. And then I say, so how many people are on your register? Oh, one. And I say, okay, so you're a practice in Westminster and you've got one homeless person on your register. There's a more interesting response, and I just have a conversation with somebody outside the room, which is actually what they say is, we're 5 minutes down the road from a really fantastic specialist service, and we direct the patients to go and register there. We offer the pay. Now, my discussion is it's really hard for me to know because people said, how do you know what's really going on? It's really hard for me to know whether that question at the reception desk is, we don't register homeless people here because there's this practice down the road, or of course you can register here, but I'd just like to tell you that there's this really good specialist service down the road. So how do we get underneath the nature, how that conversation actually happens? Because those are two completely different conversations of the actually being shown the door. To most of the patients, it's probably the best thing for them, but that's a different question from the one about the principles and the values. The other one that's a real issue in a lot of these practices where they are small, and sometimes not always, so you know, we went to a practice in Bradford, a 5-female GP practice with 3 female practice nurses and 2 female salary doctors, huge practice. No provision for men to ask for a male appointment. No way of acting. No relationships with local practice, no discussion with a local pub. And it happens vice versa, but you know, I was just doing that as an example to say it's not only men and women, in this case it was women and men. And I think that could be a significant issue in terms of homeless people, particularly if you think of some of the difficulties that they might have about disclosure or some of the things that might have happened to them. So that's a bit of a red flag for us. And an absence of vision about the organisation. Specialist homeless practices, there's vision everywhere. It's seeing way into the far distance. And often because the leadership is such that these people are just struggling to get through the day. How do we connect that together so that what you've got can be bottled and shared with some of those people so that they can get a bit of it? Either unaware or denying the existence of need. And certainly, if we're not at the rough sleeping discussion, you can imagine where we are on sofa surfing, and you can imagine where we are getting really muddled about the guidance. And was it Imran on the stage talking about asylum seekers and refugees? Refusal of registration. So specialist homeless and services are all letting everybody register using the practice address, not only for their own GP services, but for a whole range of other services. These people refuse registration. There's a lack of training and support for staff. And I think it's also, the support for staff means that they're a bit nervous, particularly the reception staff. Because they have the Daily Mail view about what homeless people want. And if you don't have the leadership in the practice, and the values of the practice that are helping to push back on that, that's where it feels a bit. And they're professionally and practically isolated, and the practical isolation means they don't view themselves as a gateway to that range of other services that that patient needs to be able to access because they don't know how to help them. So sometimes, deep in their mind, there is a, I really don't know how to help this person, so am I right to be registering them? We need to help them to think about how it is that they might change how they do that. So this is our conversation about the strategy. So we are going to have, for the first time, a comprehensive assessment by the end of this year of every single registered organisation in the country. Every care home, every domiciliary care service, every general practice, every 20% of dental surgeries, and every single hospital, including private hospitals and mental health services. We've never had that picture before. But we're not just going to go around and repeat that picture. We need to move that on now. And we also need to recognise that everything has changed. I was nearly going to break into the race song, but I won't do that to you. We need to become more effective and we need to improve as a regulator. Because I think there would be lots of conversations in this room about, in those of you experience it, it felt a bit tick boxy, it felt a bit new, it didn't really feel as if people talking to us were always able to recognise and understand what it was about what we were doing that was different. We need to get better at that. Primary care and community services are going to change hugely, and we also need to recognise that the whole regulation environment is a bit crowded at the moment. I mean, I haven't really put the Health and Safety Executive, the Vicar and Hospital Pat on that list, but it feels like there's quite a lot of people looking at you. So can we get better at only one person looking at you and able to do some work on behalf of other people? But what we've defined as quality regulation, again, interesting to that people trust and use expert independent judgment about the quality of care, that they have confidence that good and poor care will be identified, and that organisations that deliver care are encouraged to improve quality, and that organisations are encouraged to use resources effectively. So what we're doing now is we're in the middle of this strategy, so we're in this bit here in terms of consultation, and I just want to talk about two or three of the things with you. We've got six themes. One is about improving our use of data and intelligence. And that sounds like, what was that computer called in Space Odyssey? 2001. How? I think there's an issue, and I'd really like to hear some of your ideas about how do we access the local intelligence? So I've just been talking with colleagues outside from London. Apparently in London, somebody's got a list. How do we tap into those networks? Because the high level data, the POF data or the outcomes data, is only going to tell us part of that story. It's about how you put that together with local intelligence, or local data and local knowledge to turn that into intelligence. How do we do this for this group of clients, particularly when they can often be so below the radar? Where is the data? And we heard a little bit of that from our Scottish colleagues about some of the work that they've been doing, but how can you help us think about that? Implementing a single shared view of quality. Blimey. You can say nothing if we're not ambitious. So yes, there is a shared view. We need to have a more shared view of quality. I mean, that's part of the way it can be really bonkers, can't it, between your commissioners, you as providers, you as professionals, and us as the regulator. It would be good if we could get to somewhere that says, this is basically what good looks like right across the piece, and particularly the patients and clients. We then intend to target and tailor our inspection activity, and in the last one, and this is the one for us, to develop methods to assess quality for populations and in local areas. So we want to do more stuff about pathways, and we want to do some more stuff about place. Most people think one of the best things we do at the moment are the joint area inspections with Ofsted around children's services, where we do look at what are the commissioners doing, what are the providers doing, what's primary care doing. We look at the whole system and the local voluntary sector and come to an assessment working with them of what's going on in the whole system. We're going to run out of time, so do you want to just flick on? To go back to that, the one that listed the six themes. So what I was going to suggest was, perhaps in just your little groups, do you want to just have 5 or 6 minutes, perhaps taking any one of those themes, on what would you like to see it say? If it said something that was going to help you, or more importantly, if it was going to help something help us, to highlight the needs of homelessness and vulnerable people, or enable what you're doing to be better disseminated, what do you think we should be doing to do that? Does that make sense as a question?
I'm so sorry, can you repeat the question so it gets recorded or in the microphone?
So the question was about that you're particularly interested in registration.
Yeah,
so if there's a little group, because, oh sorry, I didn't see you were there when I was trying to remember what your name was earlier. Did I get it right?
Well,
Imran. I got Imran. Sorry, I apologise for that. So perhaps if there's a group that's particularly interested in looking at registration, to go in that corner, a group that's interested in looking at data, and a group that's interested in looking at quality in this population group, to go there, and a group that's looking at what might, if we were going to tailor and target our inspections, what are the things we should most target if we wanted to make a difference to what we understand about this group. I think the ones about hospitals use of resources we won't deal with. I know. Yeah, but you're from the Noble Integrated Guys and St Thomas's, providing a whole range of services to the local community. I don't know what's on the side of the building at St Thomas's. Okay, is that all right? And if we just take 10 minutes, and then we'll just come back and have some plenary discussion.
Thank you. Just
So I'm just going to quickly go round and just ask each group if there is one really burning thing they'd like to tell me. And I'm going to start with the registration group, the largest group.
I'm so sorry.
Hang on a sec.
Oh,
sorry. We're just getting some feedback.
We wondered about some kind of mass monitoring of practices who do and don't register vulnerable groups, and whether CQC may be interested in working with other relevant organisations, perhaps such as my own one, Actions England. We wondered what the two big issues, access to interpreters and the charging policy, massive implications in terms of denial of registration and widening health inequalities.
Sorry, what's the charging policy?
It's charging migrants.
About the most disadvantaged or least likely to know what expectations they might have within that system, which is our inequalities challenge, isn't it?
Anything here?
We have the borders.
Okay. Another issue for some, that joint work with NHS England as the questions as anything from this group?
Yeah, we've got, I think, 3 points.
Typical of guys from Thomas's 3 points.
We've got more.
I'm sure you have.
We talk about services that are underfunded and yet deal with some of the most complex cases.
Yeah.
And also integrated care between primary and acute care, so those referral pathways.
Yeah.
And also a case management as well.
Yeah, so we've got, yes, there's quite a lot of interest in a case management model around and how we would think about assessing that. Anything from over here?
We mentioned having a role of ensuring that we're demonstrating interagency liaison and sharing of information. We'll be looking at improving how we do that. Having data available, local individualised data available to the CQC before inspection, like making more meaningful. I think that's what you meant.
Yeah. It was more about the data that comes down from the main difference is GMT and public health is often not as detailed as what you know in practice.
Yeah.
Terms of quality we're looking at ease of access.
Yeah.
How you monitor that. So looking about self-referral, obviously primary care is self-referral, but then monitoring DNA and things like that to be more proactive in terms of that access, making sure that the service was accessible.
So I think we need to get people back for the awards ceremony. So I hope you found some of that information helpful. I'd like to thank you for your contribution in terms of giving me some other things to think about on the consultation. The consultation is still open on the CQC website, so if those of you that did write down other things, I want to put you, it's a very easy form on the back that you can just contribute those things to. And I've already had a conversation with certainly the London Nurses Network, and anybody who wants to contact me, that I will be convening at least one sort of workshop type meeting over the summer to focus on some of this stuff in more detail. And if anybody would like to be invited,
short of meeting the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre, then please drop me a note and we'll see what we can do. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're enjoying it, CQC?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a sort of, it's a kind of perfect job, because I like...
Yes,
I'm going to grab your card.
Yeah. No, it's like, it gives me the right opportunity. Because, particularly as a clinician, I mean, I've done, policy jobs as a conference for DH and stuff, and I'm really hungry, because I feel too far away from the real world. In the CQC, I'm able to do some of that, impacting the big picture, but I'm still really connected with the front line and going into general practice and seeing patients.
Do you think you will make a difference? I mean, you're picking up the problems. Do you think you'll be able to?
So at the moment, 93% of practices are rated as inadequate, are improved, and about 60% of them are good at second inspections 6 months later.
Is that what you wanted?
No, I was going to ask.
I'll leave it. I'll see you over there.
Have seen on the
Iceman. You should tell that to me. They don't move.
So what do you do if you're in that
just 3 inches out of date with MMRs? So 3 inches out of date with MMRs. We went in on Wednesday. I went to court on the Friday and it closed on the Friday afternoon. I'm not taken over by somebody else because that was dire. I'm going to a magistrate to say, this is so bad.